Come on, come on.
Sunsets and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block, where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true. Will always love you, no matter what you do.
Rise the light, the light, the light, the light, the light. Rise the light, the light, the light, the light. The light, the light, the light, the light. It's the light, the light, the light.
This is for soldiers who bust their guns. Name of freedom, not the game of funds. True queens who raise their kids, implement the knowledge, show them how to live. This is for those who stand in line to feed their babies while we're running out of time. This is for the injustice behind bars. Our lovers, our leaders, our people.
Welcome to Spitfire. Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
Welcome to another edition of Spitfire Women of Color Radio. Every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM, it's just after 6 p.m. We are live in studio with our Spitfire hosts, Victoria, Gao, Simi, and me, Alyssa.
All right, today we're going to be discussing the killing of the 18-year-old Michael Brown and the 2 weeks of protests in Ferguson. We also look at police brutality in the wake of the killing of Mike Brown by police officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. Ferguson is about 3 miles outside of St. Louis. Witnesses say Brown was shot with his hands up. And autopsy reports show that Brown was shot 6 to 8 times, twice in the head. This most recent death of a black person by the police has us all asking a perennial question. Why? Why is it okay to kill black people and people of color?
We'll also look at the solidarity between protesters in Ferguson and Palestinians in Gaza, as well as Asian American responses to police brutality. We will look at responses of celebrities, especially celebrities of color.
All right, and we're also going to be taking a look at why are we so thirsty for what Shonda Rhimes is feeding us?
switching
gears a little bit, lining up a bit, and looking at just basically images of women of color on television, and basically the first lady of all that, who is Shonda Rhimes, and who writes these women of color.
All that and more coming right up on Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Two-thirds a person, rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on blatant denial, squeezed economics, subsistence survival, deafening silence and social control.
simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so black race founded, fed us self-hatred, lies and abuse, while we waited and waited, spiritual treason, this grid and its cages, black rage is founded on these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on training and training, finding your freedom, stop your complaining, poisoning your water while they say it's raining. You're mad for complaining, complaining. Progress such human contortion. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things. When the dogs bite, when the beating, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so bad. Freedom's a prize, is it myth or illusion? Forcing you back into purpose confusion, like human trafficking or blood transfusion. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things.
Welcome back. That was Lauryn Hill with Black Rage, a song she has released in support of the residents of Ferguson. We're broadcasting live in Montreal, and the time is 6:08.
And we want to say shout out to Michael Brown's family and loved ones. I think that's often lost in this type of tragedy. And, you know, we've seen Michael Brown's mom on TV a lot. And we just want to say, you know, you're in our thoughts and our prayers. So why doesn't Black life matter? So asked Rosa Clemente in an interview with Democracy Now! This past week. Rosa Clemente is a longtime activist, journalist, scholar, and former director of the Hip Hop Caucus. And shout out, she's an alma mater of my program, Africana Studies at Cornell. Hey. In 2008, Clemente made history as part of the first all-woman of color presidential ticket in U.S. history, running as the Green Party's vice presidential nominee, along with Representative Cynthia McKinney. We covered that back in 2008, if you guys still listen to us. Clemente was in Ferguson with Talib Kweli for a mass march that took place on Saturday, August 23rd. We're now going to play an excerpt of this interview where Clemente talks about encounters with the police in Ferguson as she has been peacefully protesting.
As soon as I backed up from them, I saw the police getting ready to go in formation. And as Talib mentioned, it was before that water bottle was thrown. And as soon as I saw them go in formation, I said, yo, the cops are about to vamp on us. And we kind of started moving away. The water bottle gets thrown. There's a moment of silence and quietness. And then they just came out of nowhere. And me and Talib and Jessica grabbed hands. We got to a part where there was a concrete barrier. And we figured, well, let's not run in the streets. The cops are coming this way. Let's just get to the sidewalk and just keep going. Well, we were surrounded immediately, and where we were surrounded was a bush, and immediately put your hands up, lay down, we will shoot. Put your hands up, lay down, we will shoot. We completely complied. There were maybe about, I now count about 12 people with us on one side of the barricade, the other side of the barricade. And then this young man from the community was laying at my feet. And he was choking and breathing hard, hard. And the cop came up to him and was like, stop moving or I'll shoot you. And I was like, he's breathing. Like, and I was telling the young kid, his name is Devin. I said, just, honey, try to stay still, try to stay still, try to stay still. And he did. You know, and I have to say, as much as I've done this work for 20 years, that is the most terrifying moment of my life. All I could think about was, what happens if one of these cops, one of them shoots? That means they're all gonna shoot. What if they kill this kid in front of us? And if it wasn't for that black cop, and I'm not a cop person by any means, if that black cop didn't say, put down your weapons, we got who we wanted, let them go, we definitely would have been arrested. That was not, we thought that was gonna happen anyway. But that guy could have got trigger happy. I saw the look in his eye. He was waiting to shoot that kid. Yeah, and I think part of building the movement is also changing the narrative. It's not just African-American men being killed. Disproportionately, of course, we know that. But there are women being terrorized by police, sexually assaulted, murdered by police, by vigilantes. What is happening on the border to Latino brothers and sisters? You want to talk about a real militarized space in the United States of America. Let's look at how militarized the border is, right? And then when we look at the history in New York City, right, as they killed Yusuf Hawkins, they put Anthony Bias in a chokehold. As they killed an African immigrant, Amadou Diallo, you know, there's so many cases. And really the bigger thing is right now, how are we dealing with the system of white supremacy? How are we dealing with a system that not only views us as inhuman, both as black and brown bodies, as men and women, as children to 85-year-olds. But particularly, how are we understanding the systematic attack against us as a people? If we begin to really look, as Kimberly Crenshaw talks about, the intersection of violence, you know, there's no way we can't build a movement based off of what is happening right now. Now, these young people here in Ferguson are showing also something very different in the movement. And I think one of the things that I don't like that I'm seeing is how particularly the young people that don't fall under what we call the respectable politics are being talked about. This is their community. They are just as articulate. They might not say it in the language that academics like or journalists and all that, but this is their hood. We just came from where Michael Brown was slain and laid. These young men were showing us stab wounds from the police. Oh, this happened to me when I was 10, oh, then 12, and then the cop did this, and look at what they did, and they did this to my wife, and then they... Our communities are being terrorized by law enforcement. As Talib said, we live in that post 9/11 world where it's not only law enforcement, it's now a militarized police apparatus that is literally trying to contain us. So yesterday, when that cop tells that young kid, basically, stop breathing, so anything being black or brown is subject to you being executed at any given moment in this country. Well, I mean, I think some people may disagree with my hardcore critique on what Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon at Black Agenda Report have called the black misleadership class and a predominantly older black male misleadership class that I think when these moments happen, for the most part, the energy gravitates towards that one or two male leader that has deemed acceptable to lead the people. Now what we're seeing in Ferguson is the young people are rejecting that. We haven't seen that in a while. Like, we got you, Jesse, we respect the work. It's time for you to, no, we're not trying to hear you. Or Al Sharpton, we ain't trying to hear you. Or we respect people with collars, but we ain't trying to hear you, but we respect you. And that's how they're kind of doing it, right? So when I look at this, I also have to see it in the context, right, of working class people, the bourgeois elite. Are they now the people that are the buffers to what we want, freedom and revolution? I mean, we could kind of clear see that with the president, right? And we could kind of see that in this country, we have a abundance of African-American and Latino elected officials. And I don't see this situation changing much before the time in 1964 when we didn't have almost any African-American or Latino elected officials. I think Ferguson is, like Occupy changed the narrative on how we view capitalism, I think Ferguson is going to change the narrative of what a police brutality movement looks like and who's going to end up leading this movement. I mean, my final thoughts is, like, let's remember that a young 18-year-old boy 2 days from college was chased, gunned down, shot through the head, executed, left for 4 hours, traumatized an entire community. And that's what we should focus on at this moment. But then the larger picture is, if there's not an indictment, right, if there's not justice from injustice system, it doesn't mean we don't struggle every day to stop this. We have to find new ways. And I think part of finding new ways is doing new things. And, you know, or as Pete Seeger once said, maybe doing something little all the time as much as you can. You know, as a mother, until I saw where he laid for 4 hours, it really didn't hit me until this moment. And I'm sick and tired of this. Like Fannie Lou Hamer, I'm sick and tired of this. We have so much life to live and a limited time amount to do it. And every day, the older my daughter gets or any of my friends, all I can think about is this world better? Because it's just really not. And what is going to happen to our children? What does this do to other people in the community? How does this affect white people that are anti-racism, working against racism? All of this has been so lost in this. So we always have to remember that, and we also always have to remember that what happens in Ferguson, this has become bigger than Michael Brown's death and the family's pain. That doesn't mean we don't respect that and support that. It means, again, that this might be the catalyst, wherever that next Ferguson may be, to not have ever another Ferguson.
That was Rosa Clemente speaking with Talib Kweli to Aaron Monte of Democracy Now! Last week. They both were in Ferguson for a mass protest that took place this past Saturday. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Spitfire Woman of Color Radio, which broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we're going to continue the discussion of Ferguson and Mike Brown. Stay tuned.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
We need to speak our truths and to say no to the silencing of our voices in a racist and sexist society.
Spoken word. Interview.
What's that?
Hot.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
Tune in to Spitfire every last Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. on 90.3 FM CKUT Radio.
We're back. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Spitfire. We're a monthly radio show hosted by women of color on CKUT. We're discussing the shooting of Michael Brown by police officer Darren Wilson. Wilson is currently on paid administrative leave, and there have been no charges laid despite the fact that Mike Brown was unarmed while he was shot, and people say his hands were in the air. He was supposed to be starting college this week, and I don't think we can ever lose sight of that or any of the little, like, difficult human bits of what happens when this type of violence takes place. So, ladies, there's a lot, and I feel like we've gathered in the studio before to talk about the death of unarmed people of color, black people, who have been killed by the police and or other racially motivated individuals just acting a fool. I want to start, I think, at some of the structural elements that came out of the images that first started circulating in Ferguson a few weeks ago. So we saw tanks, we saw police in camouflage gear, which is typically gear reserved for people, military personnel in war zones. And we saw basically a complete inversion of the right to protest and the right to free speech, which has a long tradition in the United States and Canada and lots of places in the world. People have a right to take to the streets and peacefully demonstrate when they're dissatisfied. And I'm wondering if you think the way that the police response was so able to rise to a level of a pseudo-occupation, what that symbolizes in terms of the legacy of segregation and the fact that Ferguson and parts of St. Louis are very much living with this structural racism that makes this type of stuff okay. Does anyone have any thoughts on that? That was a lot. Sorry.
Can you repeat that last question again?
Break it down.
Well, maybe I should start like earlier. Is Ferguson being occupied, right? Like I heard some guy talking on the radio about how he had to go through a checkpoint. Like a police checkpoint. And there's been a call by the governor, Governor Dixon, a couple of weeks ago, more than a week ago now, to suspend civil liberties in favor of martial law, which essentially means the National Guard gets called in and no more First Amendment, which is the right to protest, freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. So is Ferguson under occupation right now?
I kind of feel like we're like that community is under a system of state repression all the time. And when people take to the streets to protest, you know, the camo gear comes out. That happened in Quebec with the student protest, right? Like there basically was a martial law declared by the government, the Sherry government, and people were basically not allowed to legally free assembly. So yeah, I guess like the question is, what's the stakes in calling it an occupation,
right?
So yeah, like when the federal government, let's say, you know, the American federal government is dishing out military equipment to police, you know, departments around the United States, like what's that all about?
Right.
They come out once in a while, like now, but the fact that the federal government is basically, well, the program's called, what is it, like
the National Defense Authorization Act? No, are we talking about that one?
The or? Pentagon program. I don't know what the actual name of the program is, but it's like a Pentagon. Maybe is that what it's called?
Oh, I'm just.
It's called the Pentagon's 1033 program.
Okay.
Which right now is in sort of the national spotlight and under great scrutiny because of what happened in Ferguson, right? So this program is brought to light. Essentially, the federal government is giving out extra military equipment to police departments around the country, and some police departments are actually being their right to participate in the program is being revoked because of misusing the equipment and or lots of the equipment, i.e. like guns and whatnot, being stolen and gone missing. Mm-hmm. So the fact that program even exists, well, basically, what does that even mean? Like, what is that? What's the significance of that in terms of like arming like the police with like municipal police, like with military gear?
Yeah, I think it's important to make a distinction between occupation by, I guess, some sort of foreign external force and state repression, because that's really what this sounds like. Because this is the federal, it's the state government that is basically militarizing internal forces like a state police or a secret police, and repressing and enacting violence against their own citizens. So I think that there are parallel structures in terms of when we talk about occupation and when we talk about apartheid and structural racism and creating situations where people are unable to physically move and structurally move. But when we look at the actual, you know, instruments of oppression, it's very, very reminiscent of just full on, like, I'm a third worlder, but like full on third world, like state repression, like, you know, like let's shoot people. Let's put them in jail. Let's just do whatever we want to do with impunity. And it is sanctioned by the government and it is promoted and it's financed by the government. But because it's the U.S., we can't really call it what it is, right? Like, there's all this, you know, there's a lot of obfuscating about, like, what is this? Is this occupation? Is this? But let's be honest about the fact that there's a machinery in place meant to oppress citizens. And maybe it's just POC citizens or Black citizens, but that is really what strikes me in this particular case.
Navi Pillay, who's the UN Special Envoy, she's been commenting a lot about what's been happening in Gaza. She is South African, what's called colored South African. I put the colored in square quotes because it has a fraught history a little bit. But she called it reminiscent of apartheid South Africa and the police tactics very similar or very familiar to her. And I think that her remarks were meant to be as much of a rhetorical flourish to kind of tell the U.S. that the world is watching what's happening, mm-hmm. as much as a reality check. Because the logic of, I guess, yeah, Victoria, you said it well, like, what is at stake in calling something an occupation when it's clear state repression? It was a deliberately provocative question, but I don't think the tactics of structural racism in the United States and the legacy that they come from deserve to be excluded inherently from what we call occupation when we think about foreign domination or foreignly held territory.
Well,
personally,
what Simi was saying, what's interesting is the instruments that are used to repress in both a situation of state repression as well as a situation of like occupation, the oppression, repression that happens in those situations, which is like incredible military tactics, you know, where you have essentially like people being killed, tear gassed, et cetera, like physical, you know, silencing violence. So I think that's kind of interesting. I listened to this like great interview today with Noam Chomsky. I can't remember what he was talking about. I'm sure he's talking about a lot of different things. One of the things he brought up was how like apartheid, you know, apartheid, on the other hand, I feel like is a very fluid category. And feel like right now, like that's, you know, when we're talking about structural racism, when we're talking about legacies of segregation, legacies of slavery in the United States from, you know, the history of Black Americans, I feel like we need to talk about, yeah, apartheid in America right now. And mm-hmm. it's really interesting. There is this news segment on Democracy Now! That came out this morning. I don't know if you guys had the chance to hear about it, but it was basically like analyzing the amount of money that the state of the city of Ferguson and like the county of St. Louis, how much they generate from the basically like the ticketing, the harassment, mm-hmm. the fines that they, you know, they take from the citizens, which is largely a Black community, like 86% mm-hmm. Black, you know, and it's like basically a budget item in terms of running that county. Like what does, you know, this is kind of like looks like apartheid to me, when people, you know, resist apartheid gets all, you know, militaristic.
Right. And yeah, I mean, so there's apartheid in the sense of it's an Afrikaans word that means separateness in Dutch. But I mean, apartheid itself was not the first apartheid in South mm-hmm. Africa, right? Like Bantustans, from my understanding, were designed off of reservations in North America mm-hmm. for Native Americans and indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And that term has become a UN classification for, you know, a way in which a caste system is created to maldistribute resources, economic power, etc. It was just a provocative question, but I wanted to move into the media coverage because we are on the media right now. We are on the message board. So I was really struck by the use of the term riot in describing protesters in Ferguson. There have been no deaths in relation to the protests. There have been isolated incidents of looting, which often takes place when there's like a lot of commotion going on in a city. And the only real violence that we can really track to this whole incident is the killing of Mike Brown by a police officer who's now on administrative leave. So what is up with this kind of characterization of predominantly brown people, black people protesting as rioters, whereas In the last few months, there have been like a lot of open carry movements going on in the United States where predominantly white men who are in favor of the Second Amendment and are protesting the Second Amendment are going out into public spaces and openly donning weapons and saying, like, here, I want, you know, don't take away my First Amendment rights. And no one is saying that these people are rioters, that these people are unruly. So what do we think about these types of characterizations in the media? If black people are protesting, suddenly there's riots, because riot is a word that has to do with race and has this like really like charged history of like race riots, and there was violence and there were fires, and really they're just protesting. And I'm really ashamed at the media, and I'm really tired of getting this kind of information just like when I'm on the subway, when I'm looking at the front page of newspapers, because there was a killing. I won't say murder because that's a legal term, but there was a killing of a kid and his body was on the street for hours, as Rosa Clemente was saying. People are upset. People don't like it when their friends get killed. And so to call this kind of like the spontaneous combustion of like outrage that has no channel, that has no strategy, and call it just kind of like a riot, when there are people walking around in the United States going into Chipotle's and Taco Bell's with their guns, sitting with their assault rifles and saying, and no one's calling them rioters, and no one's like calling in the National Guard to suspend their civil liberties. Like, what is going on in the way that these things are talked about? I just feel like it's completely never given any pale of reference, and that gives the rest of the community a pass, right? Because then if you can dismiss these people as just rioters, then you don't have to pay attention to the legitimate grievances that they're bringing to the table.
For sure. I just feel like it's a really easy go-to tactic for propagandists, you know, to just basically do character assassination. You know, they tried doing it with Michael Brown, the 18-year-old kid himself, by leaking images of him being in a convenience store prior to the killing, where he stole like a Snickers bar or something, or an energy drink. I can't remember.
It was actually less than $50 worth of cigars.
Okay.
And they've actually like complicated that and weaved that into the entire like story by saying that Wilson was justifying something, or like there was a kind of go back and forth between like justifications of him stopping Michael Brown because he had cigars or something like that, or because he was complicated in this like
convenience store.
Yeah, I know. Right. This is like,
it's just ridiculous. It's just a form to, it's just like a pathetic attempt that a lot of people like buy into because they can't handle that there are problems in the world, and like we're all either complicit within it, or, you know, it's just like too overwhelming to understand that we live in a really like unjust system. But I think it's just like a tactic. But another thing I wanted to say about that is like there is this Asian American writer. Her name is Saya Jung, and she wrote something really interesting where basically by calling it rioting or basically delegitimizing black rage or the anger that's come out of this horrible death is just another form of dehumanizing people, mm-hmm. right? It's like what you were saying, like why can't we be angry about this? Being angry is being human.
And why is it okay it's not okay to be angry about a kid getting killed by law enforcement, but it's okay to like line up in adamant defense of a police officer before you get all the facts, right? Because there's like this knee-jerk reaction. We don't need to go into like the right wing of the United States, because I just feel like there's a lot of darkness. Like once you go there, you just never know how far it's going to go. But there have been calls, like the Ku Klux Klan has raised over $300,000 to defend Darren Wilson. Yeah. Even though he hasn't been charged yet. There are like Fox News commentators are like having black guests who are at the scene on, and then just shouting them down and basically defending the police officer
Why is that the knee-jerk reaction? Like, it's just interesting to me. Like, if you're not, if it's not reasonable for people to be protesting the death of an unarmed teenager, but it's so reasonable without having any, you know, official type of investigation or any type of trial where, you know, the facts are presented and, like, sifted through to see what's true and what's not true. There's just this knee-jerk defense of the police. Like, to me, that's just so clearly racially motivated, you know? It's exactly. And they're not being called as, like, hecklers, you know, angry elderly people who just can't seem to have any compassion. Like, I just don't, I mean, I understand. I don't want to say, like, I don't understand. It doesn't make any sense. But it's so, again, like, we need to hold these media outlets accountable because they put so much information out there. Like, they're 24-hour networks in a lot of cases. And right. People are absorbing this and losing sight of, like, this kid who got killed.
Right. And, like, some looting and a bunch of protesters versus, like, tear gassing these protesters and not, you know, underscoring that extreme response to people, you know, gathering together and protesting.
I also wanted to add right before we kind of finish part one of this discussion that even like journalists were tear gassed. And so it's kind of like a prevention of the general public getting this information that may not be, you know, on the right wing's like agenda. So, we're going to break now with some Erykah Badu.
Spitfire.
More excitement. More everything. Everything.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Across space.
Step right up and step off the train.
The land before time.
Welcome to America.
All the freaks are here.
All you have to do is make a promise.
I promise.
And stay
I
on promise. The grind.
You give it to me, I'll give it to
30,
you.
30,000 megawatts of power, baby. Radiating your soul.
Sign right here on the dotted line.
Come on, get you some free.
I promise.
Ladies and gentlemen, before exiting the train,
I promise.
Please leave
I
your
promise.
Valuables.
You give it to
diamonds,
me.
Rubies, and pearls.
I promise.
In
I promise.
The cabinet that Jason Taylor left. The pussycats and the jackals, you can leave them with me.
Promise to you, baby.
You
I love you tooth for tooth and eye for eye.
Cause we take your history and make it a modern mystery. You see what I'm saying? Disturbance over here.
Keep
her
around.
I want everyone to see this.
I give you my hand, I give you my lips, I give you my tongue, I give you my gun.
See?
Give me
you see how easy
yes, young, yes, little girl.
Has anyone seen my 42 laws?
Oh, I'm sorry. We're not responsible for lost articles and things.
Oh.
Okay, so whenever he say a key word, everybody just shout on cue.
That's not science.
We're back. We've been talking about the death of Michael Brown and the response by the police, both to the protesters and the way that his death was handled in the first place. We don't have much time, so I'm just going to ask Victoria to share some thoughts that she had in relation to what Talib Kweli, who was with Rosa Clemente in Ferguson, had to say about what he was seeing on the ground.
So something that's really interesting that, okay, he said two things that were kind of interesting. And if you want to see the full interview, you can check it out on Democracy Now! It came out, I think, a couple days ago. Talib Kweli, Black Star, you know, he's, you know, amazing rap artist. We love him. He said something really interesting about Twitter and how, like, he loves Twitter and everyone's tweeting and retweeting and, like, showing solidarity through hashtags. We even have some cross-national, cross-continental solidarity between, like, Gazans and Ferguson people. There's a lot of, like, stuff going on in Twitter, but real change will only come when you stop and move your body physically to a place where other people are and, you know, rise up and, like, you know, show some solidarity in person. So that's why he went down. And I really like that idea. And I also really liked what he said with regard to his role as an artist. So he's saying that as an artist, he has a responsibility to the people that listen to his music. And so he needs to show solidarity to the people and, like, come down and like, participate in this consciousness raising, this protesting against, like, state repression, you know, violence against Black America, you know, because it's, you know, it's like, you know, that's his role as an artist. So yeah, I really love that. So yeah, Simi,
go for it.
Yeah, so shifting gears a little bit, we're going to talk a little bit more about Shonda Rhimes and how she basically sort of
will not talk about Michael Brown on her shows.
Well, yeah, will not talk about Michael Brown on her shows and her female characters and characterization of women of color. We love Olivia Pope. We love her. We love her white suits, her words, which are like daggers, her take no prisoners attitude. But she is essentially this generation's fictitious Sally Hemings. Basically, she is an Ivy League educated, well-spoken Sally Hemings, but she's basically Sally Hemings. And it's interesting, at least for me, to note the polarizing effect of the Olivia Pope figure on walk audiences, on women of color audiences. We all hate the other woman, this sort of mistress, you know, stooping the powerful man character. And yet we're all somewhat inextricably drawn to her. And we're all somewhat, it's quite a weird thing. And this seems to be a trend with most of Shonda Rhimes' writing and her writing on female characters. And we see this in Grey's Anatomy, we see this in Scandal, and specifically with how she treats women of color characters, but also with female characters in general. They're deeply polarizing figures. They're powerful, they're decisive, they're rapier sharp women, but they all have these sort of fatal flaws. As I said before, Olivia Pope likes to stoop the president. Christina Yang is basically an unfeeling, emotionless being. And yet we're okay with it. We love it. We lap it up as if we were dying of thirst in the desert and Shonda offered us the last drop of rainwater hanging from a random cactus leaf. We love it. But why are we so thirsty for what Shonda is feeding us? Is it because we believe she offers an alternative to the stereotypes, to the mammy stereotype and the Jezebel and the dragon lady and the China doll stereotype? Is that really what she's doing? But does she really? She doesn't. Is she just giving us a glossy, glamorous Web 2.0 version of more of the same? So Olivia Pope in Scandal and Christina Yang from Grey's are basically just updated derivatives of the same old. And in fact, we could even argue that their woke identities don't even come into play in their storylines at all. They're just characters who happen to be of color. Mm. Yeah. Now, I don't want to throw shade at Shonda. Maybe this is all part of her liberal post-racial project or whatever. But I just wanted to put it out to you, fellow Spitfires. Why do you think we are so thirsty for what Shonda is feeding? Why do you love her? Or love to hate her? Or love to hate Olivia Pope?
Can I just say that I don't actually love these shows? But I can participate in the discussion.
Yes, fair enough.
Or... I have love, like, for both of us, for scandals. So I think it'll be fine.
Break it down.
Yeah, So there's so many... There's three things I was thinking of. The first is that I think the problem is that people keep replacing pop culture with critical thinking and activism, right? So it's the whole Beyonce is, like, the feminist of our time. Yeah. When really there are people who... Not that she doesn't identify as a feminist or doesn't say she's a feminist, but there are feminists who... don't have a pot to pee in, who are doing the work of feminism on the ground in ways that have nothing to do with Beyonce. And I just feel like you don't replace Beyonce with... If Beyonce is your 98% of your feminism, then you need to look elsewhere. And it's kind of how I feel about this. It's like, if Olivia Pope is your version of, like, hey, I made it because now I can watch a black lady on TV who's stripping the president, like, there's a problem. But the other thing is, it's like, there is something really powerful in seeing... And just seeing Olivia Pope have a voice, even if that voice is a caricature or is reminiscent of a lot of kind of stereotypes about black females that are being mapped onto her. Like, I'm a little bit, it's very interesting to me as somebody who, you know, wants a really high powered career one day to see this, like, high powered black woman who has, like, her hair pressed, who, you know, wears these, like, nice suits, going out and doing her thing. And I think that's my thirst for it. I can be honest about that. Like, I'm seduced by those images, even if they're really basic, which is kind of sad. I feel like it just says a lot about media, like, and how, like, desperate they've got us because they don't give us anything that we want. And then the other thing is that, you know, I just go back to, like, we can't make Scandal the place where, like, black feminism, you know, like, Scandal is not about black feminism. Yeah. Scandal is, like, a mainstream show on ABC, which is owned by Disney, you know, that is, like, trying to get ratings to, like, the masses of Americans who, like, have turned off, like, most network TV because it doesn't have as much sex as, like, cable TV does. Yeah. So I guess I'm just kind of like, of course it is what it is. Of course there's, like, some salacious affair. Of course, like, the president's, like, this Republican white man. You know, that's how else was that going to work? You think they're going to have, like, Barack Obama's, like, person on TV, like, having an affair with Kerry Washington? I don't know, like, would they even allow that? You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like there's certain, they're so confined within that, like, network corporate space that, like, what else were we going to get?
But I mean, like, even when you think about it, even on cable TV, like, even when there are supposedly alternative images, like, look at, like, something like Orange is the New Black. Like, really, like, what even the alternatives are super, super normative.
I just have to say that BET... financed Shala Lynch's predominantly financed Shala Lynch's Angela Davis documentary.
Really?
Yeah.
And they're owned by Viacom.
Man. Yeah, man. So she got Jada Smith, like, on her side to, like, basically petition, like, get the support, and, like, BET called her and was like, okay, we're gonna finance your movie before it was even before they even started shooting. Like, they didn't have, you know, they didn't have the money. So, like, it's interesting, like, when you decide as a writer, as a filmmaker, as an actor to do a project and just go for it because you believe in it. It's, you know, it's like Talib Kweli, he's, like, going down to the front lines because he, you know, he's, like, he's living life, like, kind of one with, I don't know, I just feel like you can still put work out there into mainstream spaces. And and I think so.
That's, yeah. And that's, I think, a really good critique is, like, okay, so now Shonda Rhimes is, like, in this powerhouse in ABC, and she could be using her clout to bring in, like, interesting, like, you know, countercultural voices. Although content. Maybe this Octavia
Viola Davis.
I always mix up. I always say Octavia Davis because Octavia Spencer was the other maid in The Help. That's really bad. Viola Davis. Sorry.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it'll be a great show.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm more sympathetic, I guess, because I think I'm not trying to excuse like this like seduction of like, you know, being popular and like famous and having your ideas like mass consumed. I'm not saying that that's a good thing, but you know, there's just so few opportunities for these women, and so it's like it's nice to see them succeeding. I don't know. Like I feel I don't expect them to be like radical. Like I don't expect Kerry Washington to be radical. Kerry mm-hmm. Washington is like a cute, you know, a middle class girl from the Bronx who like loves Barack Obama. That's who she is. Like she's not advocating for anything else other than that.
Yeah. And I think that's something I guess also to consider is that in this context is class privilege in some ways, does that really obscure sort of real, I mean, racial issues, or does that really obscure your lens and your experience of race in some ways? Is Shonda Rhimes basically writing her experience? So is she basically like, I'm just writing about these characters and they happen to be women of color, but in some ways that doesn't really feature in how the world sees them, how they go about their lives. You know, it's a little bit, I mean,
maybe she's lying to herself, you know, and so she wants black women in her to be in her saying her words.
Yeah.
But she can only take it, you know, it's like she's confined within that world of writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
And that's maybe the cost benefit analysis she's made to, you know, be successful in ABC world. I don't know.
Or maybe that is her black experience. And maybe.
Is there
something wrong with that? I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, I'm all for diversity of experiences, but it's a little bit alienating in some ways too.
Totally. Yeah, definitely. Like at a certain point, it's like, you know, I demand more from artists, I demand more from like the president of the United States of America, like mm-hmm. just because he's black doesn't mean he doesn't drop bombs on children.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I don't know. Anyways,
we should say too that we came up with this idea, this topic in light of, you know, the kind Harry Belafonte's fight with Jay-Z, which occurred last summer over the George Zimmerman verdict. George Zimmerman was the shooter and killer of Trayvon Martin. However, he was acquitted of all charges. And Harry Belafonte, who has marched with Dr. Martin Luther King, who's like a famous singer, American singer, his point was just like, you know, there's like a whole generation of celebrities who aren't showing up. And mm-hmm. to him, that's kind of anathema, because when he was going through it, you know, being a black celebrity meant you were with Dr. King, with these civil rights icons. So like, what has happened? What is the shift? And, you know, so now there's this space where you can be a black celebrity, a celebrity of color, and have no connection to, you know, Michael Brown or what's mm-hmm. going on in Ferguson, and be totally okay with that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, what's up?
But I wonder, is this also somewhat like symptomatic of how we do activism now, right? Like, mm-hmm. is the way to do it, oh yeah, I'll just, you know, post a Twitter hashtag because, you know, like I'm on my grind. Anybody got time to be marching at the front lines? Like, I donate, you know, like it's really like,
yeah.
I mean, it's quite disheartening to think about, but I feel like there definitely is this, this very individualistic, you know, I speak with my money, or I speak on Facebook, or I speak with social media trend that seems to be taking over everything.
All right. So why don't we shift gears a bit, wrapping up the show for this month with a bit of the stuff we love. Now we're going to share with you some samples of the stuff we love, if you guys don't mind.
Yeah, this is a new segment on our show for all you Spitfire lovers out there, you know, being such cultural.
Mixing it up.
Yeah, exactly. You were sitting on all this like cultural capital. We'd like to share with you stuff. I'm going to share this awesome thing that I shared with Alyssa the other day. Fashion Bomb Daily. It's a great blog.
Love
I don't know
it.
If you ladies
love her hair.
Yeah. Fashion Bomb Daily. It's a great blog that features like fashion stuff with women of color. It's amazing. Check it out. Yeah, for your fashion styling tips.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, V. Do you want to go?
Yeah, I want to go. I just finished today on the metro here. I know I'm a little bit late to the party. Juno Diaz's The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. And I loved it, and it blew my mind. And yeah, and I mean, there were just so many things I liked about it. And I know Juno Diaz is not a woman of color, but there definitely was some woman of color content in there. I love his voice, love the delivery, and the story was, you know, fun, but poignant and very, yeah, you should definitely check it out if you want to.
I actually took a suggestion and watched Pushing Hands.
I saw it too. I was going to talk about it, but I, no.
Oh, I'm glad you didn't.
I love that movie.
Pushing Hands?
Yes. Pushing Hands.
Pushing Hands was the was a movie that Lily, our actually co-contributor, suggested the other meeting
we
had.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys should watch it. I think that maybe Alyssa should talk about her favorite, Janet Mock.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, you know, if you watch the show, you know I love me some Janet Mock. And I read her book this summer, her autobiography, Redefining Realness, My Path to Woman Life, Womanhood, and So Much More. Oh, I think I messed up that subtitle. But it was just so great. And she, if anyone's ever seen her speak in person, she's just got such an amazing, peaceful presence. And you don't realize behind her peace, sense of peace, how much pain and trauma and difficulties, you know, she's been through. And it was so wonderful to so young, who's kind of like our peer, have such a clear articulation and command over her experience and share it with everyone in a really refreshing way that brings in so many different elements, the history of colonization in Hawaii, because she's part Pacific Islander, her experience, you know, navigating her transition with her parents, particularly her father, living briefly in a predominantly Black neighborhood during the height of the crack epidemic. You know, just getting a full scholarship to go to the university, eventually coming to New York. It's a great read. You can read it in like 2 days. I totally recommend it.
Thanks, Alyssa.
Thank you.
I bought the book. I have it. I'm going to read it.
I know you're going to read it. And I'm going to look at Fashion Bomb daily.
Daily.
All right. So Spitfire Women of Color broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. You can write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca and check us out at spitfire.blogspot.com. Also, follow us on Twitter at Spitfire Radio!
Bye!
Bye!
See ya!
Turn me up. I wanna hear the music.
Yeah.
I wanna feel that vibe.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we're here.
All over the world, man. Gotta make that money, man. Make your money, y'all. Just do what you got to do.